Murphy's Law does not apply this morning.
I made some work for him. Well, I mentioned to Jerry from the Edison side that, you know, that about some of the test presses we have. He said, well, do you have the matrix numbers? And I said, I think Chuck does, but they said the Edison side would be interested in the matrix.
The first paper, which will be presented, was written by Jerry Gibson. Jerry is the audio and moving image preservation specialist at the Library of Congress's Preservation and Research Testing Division. Unfortunately, he's not able to be here with us, but he did send the paper on and some slides, and Chuck Haddix is going to present it.
When Jerry Gibson asked me, and well, actually I volunteered to read this paper, I didn't realize what I was getting myself into because there's a lot of real technical stuff in here, and it's written in Jerry Gibsonese, so if I stumble a little bit, you'll have to forgive me. But I think I encouraged Jerry to develop this particular program for a couple of different reasons. One, I think this is a topic that hasn't been discussed enough, tape deterioration, in a very clear, logical manner, and that's basically what he's done. And we all have tapes in our collections that kind of surprise us. We get the request from the patron. Recently, I had a woman come in and ask for a tape of a program called Diary of a Disaster, and it's a documentary that was done on the Ruskin Heights tornado some 40 years ago here in Kansas City, and it came from a broadcaster named Walt Bodine, and I thought I was being wise back in 1991, you know, it's the old wise fool thing, when I took those acetate tapes and dubbed them onto poly tapes, and that was 1991. I pulled the poly tape off of the shelf, put it on the trusty Studer, and much to my surprise, it started squealing and shedding the oxide. This is a five-year-old tape. Fortunately, I kept the acetate original, pulled it off the shelf, cleaned the heads, played just fine, and it's still there. It outlasted actually what I considered to be the preservation master. Uh-oh. And we all know the villains in this, one of many villains. This is a 3M tape. I'm going to pass this around, and the last person that gets it in their hand, would you please put it back on the table? And this has the cotton swab that I used to clean the tape guides. And this is remarkable in that this tape only lasted 5 years. So I think Gibson was right on with his work, and hopefully I think with some of his recommendations, our collections can last a lot longer. And Jerry couldn't be with us today, particularly because of a couple things combined, personal commitments and budget restraints combined to keep Jerry here. However, he does encourage people to send him some feedback on this issue. And I have his email address, also his phone number. So I will give that at the end of the paper. For the working career of everyone in this room and for the lives of most of us, magnetic tape is part of our everyday world and carrier of much of the information and entertainment that we receive. Even though it has repeatedly been identified as unacceptable as a preservation medium, of course, we've now found the acceptable form of a preservation medium. Some are now speculating that tape may have a life expectancy exceeding that of many paper documents and equal to safety-based films if handled and stored with similar care, reason, procedures, and criteria. Regardless of your opinion of tape as a long-term data carrier, it is a fact of life which audio collectors, librarians, and archivists have long accepted that with which we work. When compared with the early successes of first the cylinder, then the disc, I'm of the opinion that 78 RPM records are the only true archival medium, personally. Magnetic recording had a relatively slow start. The earliest documented evidence we have tells us that it was introduced by Vladimir Poulsen in 1893, with a Danish patent issued to Mr. Poulsen in 1898, followed by the U.S. patent in 1900. The earliest known American company manufacturing magnetic recording equipment was the American Telegraphone Company, founded in 1903. Numerous advances were made in magnetic recording technology throughout the first four decades of this century by work in this country and abroad, with some of the most notable breakthroughs in tape technology coming from Germany immediately before and during World War II. Radio companies were using magnetic recorders from early in the process, with such notable landmarks as BBC adding the technology in 1930, the German radio in 1935, equipment of significant quality installed in Radio Luxembourg in 1941, ABC radio first using the technology in 1948, and the first reel of commercial videotape being used at CBS television in 1956. I always pause when I'm giving tours of the archives and point out to students that I grew up in a time where before television, before there was a method of storing recorded sound besides open reel, and when there were no videotapes, and they always look at me in shock, and they wonder how I came up. I think that's what made me so demented. Still, as far as most collectors, libraries, and archives are concerned, magnetic tape can generally be considered as simply a footnote to audio history until well after World War II. From a relative slow beginning, magnetic tape has increased significantly in importance in our world. A Library of Congress survey of 500 archives, which was administered by Jerry Gibson, in 1993, it was projected that there were over 26 million audio and video tapes held by institutions worldwide. Of these, approximately 17 million were audio tapes, the rest were video, and to a significantly less degree, soundtracks to motion pictures. Even if these figures are incorrect, even by as much as 50%, we would still find over 13 million tapes reported, with at least 8.5 million audio tapes in archival collections. By anyone's reckoning, that's a lot of tape. In today's presentation, I will attempt to summarize some of the deterioration problems facing this medium, how to recognize them, what to do to recover the data and or the tape when they occur, and they will occur, and how to reduce the risk of their development. Even though I suspect that that Jerry's observations will apply to virtually all magnetic tape, regardless of base, type of recording, or format, for the sake of time, and because our primary interest here, I will limit the conclusions to the format which the Technical Committee of ARSC, YASA, and the Audio Preservation and Restoration Standards Committee of the Audio Engineering Society all cite as being acceptable for audio preservation: polyester-based open-reel analog tape. Excluded are digital, cassette, and cartridge tapes, or magnetic media in its various forms, disc, wires, and with one exception that I'll cite later, tape on other backings. Further, as important as it is in the ability to retrieve data recorded onto a tape, I'm not going to consider the record or playback system, except as they may directly affect the deterioration of the tape itself. One thing about being the local head of the local arrangements committee, you can make things very convenient for yourself, and you set that right up there. As I'm sure most of you already know, magnetic tape is a laminate made of materials capable of taking a magnetic charge. Writing on a film base with the potential of one or more additional layers added for various purposes, such as reducing friction, dissipating static, aiding in a more uniform tape pack. The top layer of this sandwich is made up of magnetic particles suspended within a binder. This binder is presently most often of various polymers, has been composed of such as cellulose nitrate, chlorine bearing vinyls, and sundry epoxy and acrylic resins. In addition to carrying the magnetic particle in complete dispersion and to depositing the uniform coating of the mixture by solvent release without solvent attack on the base, the binder must also provide a smooth surface to ease movement of the tape through the equipment, join securely to the base, be strong enough not to rub off during record, playback, or storage, not adhere to adjacent winds of tape, even under strong pressure and tension, and not craze, flake, or peel. Sounds like a new rock group. To aid in its functions, the binder has frequently had numerous additives, some successful and some unsuccessful, including lubricants to reduce friction, cleaning agents to reduce head clogs, carbon black to reduce static charge, and fungicides to reduce or prevent mold growth. Currently, the binder typically used for magnetic tapes, whether audio, video, or computer data, is a polyester urethane elastomer. The magnetic particles today are most commonly ferric oxide of uniform shape and size. Various other materials have been used over the years, such as chromium dioxide and metal particles. However, due to its relative stability, the majority of tapes of concern to us here use iron oxides. The first widely distributed magnetic tape had a paper base coated with iron oxide particles. Paper base was replaced by cellulose acetate base, and that was used extensively from the 1940s to the early 60s. Although cellulose acetate is reasonably durable, it is more susceptible to the environment in which it is stored, shipped, or used, more so than poly. Acetate base can change over its lifetime and is known to dry out and become brittle, losing its strength in the process. Since the 1960s, polyester has generally been adopted as by most tape manufacturers because it's strong, chemically inert, and less affected by environmental conditions than its predecessors. Another base material used, especially within Europe, is polyvinyl chloride. In addition to the base and binder, most tapes produced since 1980 also have some type of back coating that acts as an aid to tape packing on the hub and reel. The dimensions of magnetic tape can vary significantly from less than 1/4 inch to 1.5 mils in thickness, from 1/8 inch to less than more than 2 inches in width, and from a few feet to potentially infinite length. The paper today groups deterioration problems by the part of the tape they seem to affect most, base, oxide, or magnetic particles. The deterioration problem associated with the base are physical deformation, including stretching, breaking, and the vinegar syndrome. Polyester, the base of most modern magnetic tape, is very stable and will almost certainly outlast the other parts of the sandwich that make up the package. Nonetheless, if improperly handled, stored, or used, it is vulnerable to being deformed and hence of distorting the data on it and or preventing the tape from playing at all. Improperly wound rolls of tapes or tapes with excessive pack stresses are likely to become distorted and to have tracking problems when played. Physical deformation of the base of the tape can take many forms. Such as pop strands. There's an example of pop strands, and there's a slide of some pop strands. That's when several strands or wraps of tapes protrude from the edge of a roll of the tape, and it's most likely to occur when the pack is wound improperly. Since pop strands cause the tape to unwind unevenly, it can produce edge damage when the tape is played and presents more tape surface area to airborne particulate matter, which can damage the oxide and or the backing and also reduce your tape to head contact. Pack slip is a lateral movement of sections of tapes. There we go. sections of tape pack caused, it's caused by high and low spots and otherwise smooth tape pack. Pack slip is most likely to occur when the pack is wound improperly. Like pop strands, since it since it causes the tape to unwind unevenly, pack slip can cause edge damage when the tape is played and presents more tape surface area to a particulate matter, which can damage the oxide and or the backing, as well as reduce proper tape-to-head contact. Though different from pack slip, and though creating other problems, interleaving tape of different widths of tape onto a roll This slide shows how what happens, what it looks like when acetate and polyester tape are spliced together. The polyester is slightly narrower than the acetate, and or when improperly made splices can have a similar effect on tape integrity. Cinch tape is the wrinkling or unfolding over of it on tape itself. Usually when loose tape is, it stops suddenly. This can cause creasing of the tape and, of course, dropouts. Stretched tape can cause curvature problems and can be across the full width of the tape or, most likely, on one or another side of the tape. Usually results from either improper wind or from faulty equipment. It'll distort the signal, but the data can generally be retrieved from an analog tape. Of course, another problem is breaking, and that's generally an unwanted separation of the tape into two or more parts, usually resulting from very sloppy handling or use of equipment or improperly calibrated equipment is what I found. I'm going to try something here. Don't try this at home. All right. This is a cross-section of a good pack, and not exclusively related to the base. Flange pack is a state where the tape pack is good, but is wound up against one of the flanges of the tape reel. This is pretty common. This is generally caused by either malfunctioning equipment or loose wind. Flange pack can damage the edge of the tape. Although outside of the scope of this presentation, Jerry feels it's imperative to mention a potential problem with acetate base tape used extensively in the 40s and 50s. He says potential, since he's unaware of actual examples where acetate-based magnetic tape, as distinguished from magnetic strip or magnetic soundtracks of motion picture film, have actually been shown to suffer the vinegar syndrome. For those of you who have not experienced it, vinegar syndrome is something that really affects motion picture film. I remember visiting an archives and having this guy proudly show me his film collection, which was stacked in a room on the floor, and the smell of vinegar was overwhelming. And I had to bite my tongue on that one. Vinegar syndrome is an catalytic decomposition process of acetate cellulose. And it's caused by the evaporation of acetic acid. Affected thus far are motion picture films and some microfilms, but the presumption is that all cellulose acetate-based materials will go through the same process. Some have said that it gives off a faint odor of vinegar. I can tell you, it gives off an odor of vinegar. If you've got vinegar syndrome, you definitely know it. Vinegar syndrome has not yet appeared on magnetic tape, but I think it's something that we definitely need to keep an eye on, because when it reaches the point where the film is discolored and frequently unable to support the emulsion and advances to a state where the emulsion becomes very brittle. If you locate vinegar syndrome in your collection or any other kind of preservation problem, mold or anything, be sure and isolate those items from the rest of the collection. Ironically, we are able to slow the advancement of vinegar syndrome, and the consensus is that all acetate material will eventually develop it, but it can be delayed for literally hundreds of years if they properly maintain and store the materials at a temperature below 40 degrees Fahrenheit and below 25% relative humidity. It's not a good idea to freeze the tape, as some manufacturers use lubricants which reportedly solidify on the surface below 30 degrees Fahrenheit. There's no known method of reversing vinegar syndrome once it begins, but if found in time before the base shrinks too much or is unable to support oxide or becomes too brittle, with any luck you should still be able to play and re-record the information. And for more information on the vinegar syndrome, you can check out the Image Permanence Institute's IPI storage guide for acetate film. Even though all of the physical parts of the magnetic tape can cause breakdown, it seems universally agreed that with modern polyester tape, the binder is the weak link, and it is the binder which generally generates problems. Deteriorations of the oxides can take many forms: blocking, creasing, lubricant loss, oxide loss, sticky shed syndrome, friction, and tape squeal, just to name a few. Blocking is the sticking together of two or more winds in the tape pack, most often resulting from deterioration of the binder, storage at high temperature, and or excessive pack pressure. Let me shut the lights down a little bit up here so you can see this. Is that a little bit better?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll be able to read my paper, or Jerry's paper, but yeah, I can. Also, another problem is creasing. And this is generally caused by cinching or by mishandling of the tape. And it can cause dropouts and data loss. Lubricant loss is an inevitable part of the aging, just as sticky shed, but is directly related to storage and use conditions. It will cause increased friction of the tape when being used, resulting in overheating of the tape and increased head wear, and may also contribute to sticky tape, sticky shed oxide loss, tape squeal, and head clog. And it can sometimes be temporarily corrected by judicious application of lubricants. Mistracking occurs when the playback head does not accurately coincide to the recorded path of the magnetic tape, usually because of some physical deformation in the base or damage to the tape edge. If severe, recorded information will either not play or will be distorted. Rewinding and environmental staging of the tape may help. Oxide loss is the actual separation of part or all of the oxide from the base. It results from a number of different things, including poor binder adhesion to the base, natural aging of the tape, and unnecessary friction and scratching of the tape. Once it occurs, it is not easily, if ever, correctable. It generally meets even with the most stringent definition of tape failure. Sticky tape, in which one or another elements or materials from the outside cause the tape to adhere to unwanted surfaces, generally caused by breakdown of either the back coating or the oxide binder. It may cause blocking, head clogs, oxide loss, such as sticky shed, alternate sticking and slipping of the tape as it goes across the heads, and tape squeal. Like sticky shed, tape can generally be recovered for a short time by either cleaning or various environmental treatments, extended storage at low temperatures and relative humidities, or baking. Tapes reported in 1988 by Kent Scott as having sticky problems include Ampex 406, 407, and 456, AGFA 369 and 469, and 3M 226, 250, and 256. Please let Jerry know, or you can let me know, if you have any additions to that villains list. Sticky shed is deposits of tape, usually in the oxide, that come off into the various parts of the equipment when sticky tapes are played. I'm going to skip these overheads because they're not clear anyway. But he talks about initial examination of sticky tape under a scanning electronic microscope at 11,000 plus magnification seems to show that good tape, in this case Agfa 406, has a smooth, reasonably unblemished surface, where the same tape stock, which had sticky shed problems recorded in 1979, shows what appears to be holes or dips in the surface of the tape, presumably where the oxide has become separated from the base and collected into the tape guides and heads. Tape squeal is the high-pitched noise that is made as sticking tape alternately sticks to, then rapidly releases from the record or playback heads. The primary problems which occur with recorded signals during the storage and demagnetization and the introduction of magnetization other than that originally recorded. Most often these will either be print through, demagnetization, or dropouts. Print through is the recording of low frequency signals from one or more windings of the tape onto adjacent layers is described as a ghost signal heard slightly before the actual audio recording. Since the strength of the ghost signal is practically proportional to the strength of the new master signal, all materials should be recorded below 2% harmonic distortion. 4 dB from normal recording levels is a figure that is often given. Print through generally can be removed by rewinding the tape before playing and is frequently given as an additional reason for storing audio tape tails out. If rewinding fails to remove enough of the ghost signal, selective erasure is possible, although it should not be used indiscriminately or carelessly. Demagnetization, or the loss of recorded signal, can generally be dismissed fairly easily for tape in storage. It does occur, but is primarily a weak field or high frequency problem. If a tape is improperly recorded and stored, even if only in normal office environment, the amount of magnetic field decrease will usually be unnoticeable. Dropouts are brief signal losses caused by either a tape head clog, missing oxide, a defect in the tape, debris from on a tape or machine, or any other situation that reduces the head to tape contact. I'm always surprised when I review the comparative size of the tape and tape head with some of the materials flying around in the air, when we realize that even the smallest airborne particulate matter can cause a dropout, it's amazing that this technology works at all. Restoration of deteriorated tape is an intricate process that works on one problem that may well destroy or at least accelerate a seemingly similar problem. Sticky tape can be caused by either binder breakdown, lubricant loss, and exuding, or problems with the backing. Don't assume that all problems are the same because they create similar complications. When carrying out any action that might reasonably be irreversible, such as baking or chemical treatments or buffing the tape, be sure that you are treating the correct illness and you are not destroying the very thing you are trying to save. Do not do no harm. I guess that's the first commandment here. Baking can, dependent upon the deterioration problem the tape has developed, temporarily improve the binder problem, allowing sticky tapes to be played. Ampex is now a part of Quantigy. Reports that treating a sticky tape at 122 Fahrenheit for 3 days will sufficiently firm up the binder so that the tape can be played. The effect of the treatment is temporary, however, and it is recommended that the tape be copied within 1 to 2 weeks. It is not known how many times a tape can be baked, cycling back and forth between the sticky fire, sticky succession, before it fails completely or the signal is distorted or altered beyond use. Care should be taken that the temperature is well controlled specifically unless there is absolutely no other option, and the hair dryer in a box does not give adequate controls of heat and humidity, and is not a recommended solution. Chemical treatments, including addition or replacement of lubricants, is another process that has been developed to recover tape with sticky oxide or loss of lubricants. Like baking, it should be used with the greatest of care. The only processes I know of are considerably proprietary and have not been made for available for public use. Pellon tape cleaner, in general, tape cleaning should follow the same basic premise as any other delicate item. Use only as much effort and force as is absolutely necessary. To do even that will probably shorten its life expectancy. To do more will probably actively destroy the tape. In general, clean with a soft, lint-free cloth, such as 3M's Pellon. Use moisture and chemicals sparingly. Some have reported notable success with environmental conditioning staging of tape instead of either baking or treatment with chemicals. If time allows, try staging sticky tape in the recommended 40 degrees Fahrenheit and 20 to 25% relative humidity before undertaking more stringent measures. Take your time on this. I personally have used the Pellon, and it works pretty good. You have to usually give it a couple of passes. You don't hit it real hard at first. What you do is you hit it maybe twice very lightly, and you do get a good pass at it. However, I've never tried the baking, and I'm kind of interested in that, but it seems kind of extreme. Careful rewinding of physically deformed tape, warped, wrinkled, or creased tape, as well as tape with popped strands, pack slip, cinching, or flange pack tape should be attempted before more aggressive measures with such as pressing or ironing the tape is tried. If the tape is really important to you or your collection, get professional advice. Don't wing it alone. Though it is not recommended for archival or master material, splicing is available to send broken or cut tapes, to mend broken or cut tapes, as well as those so badly damaged in other ways that portions of the recording must be sacrificed and discarded in order to salvage the greater part. If splices are necessary, always use tape specifically made for this purpose and make the splices as neat as possible. And if the recording is really important, make an unspliced copy of the repaired tape for archival storage. Since magnetic tape is a physical object, and since all physical objects deteriorate, magnetic tape will deteriorate regardless of what is done to it or with it. As Pickett and Lemko observed in their study, Preservation and Storage of Sound Recordings, published in 1959, the resistance of an article to degradation is built into it at the time of manufacture. While we can change the article after it is received, we can do things which allow it to realize its full life potential rather than shortening it. For example, the methods we use and the manner in which we handle, package, store, record, and or play the magnetic tape will almost certainly have a significant effect on whether the tape develops sticky sheds problems in 5 years or in the lives of our grandchildren. To have the greatest confidence that your tape will last, here's some suggestions. Use only good quality, low print through polyester-based tape, 1.5 mils thick, no splices, even for the leader. Handling the tape as little as possible, preferably always wearing clean, lint-free gloves. Never touch the actual surface of the tape or the edge of the tape unless absolutely necessary. Handle the tape carefully, and be sure not to press the flanges into the edges of the tape or to damage the flanges. Replace them immediately if the flanges become bent or out of line. Now there's a bent flange for you. I don't think so. Do not drop or throw a tape, regardless of how well it is packaged or how mad you are. Record tape at the maximum level below 2% harmonic distortion, 4 dB below normal recording level, is usually satisfactory. Leave the first and last 15 feet of blank tape, feet blank of program material. Use only open reels with an unslotted hub of NAB design of the largest possible diameter, preferably 10 and a half inches or larger. Be sure that the flanges of the reel are removable so that they may be easily replaced without doing unnecessary damage to the tape if they become deformed or out of plane. Leave tape, all tape, even cassettes, in the play-through or tails-out position. In other words, do not fast-forward or rewind a tape that is going into storage. Play-wind 1.5 mil tape on a well-adjusted machine that at no more than 30 inches per second from start to finish before placing it in storage. Pickett and Lemko specifically specify a wind of constant torque, the type of wind often used as tape leaves the factory, of 3 to 5 ounces at the hub of a 10.5-inch NAB reel. Secure the ends of the tape with either a tape made specifically for this purpose or by a tie-down collar that is wrapped around the tape and secured inside the tape flanges. Do not use such as adhesive tape or mending tape. Of course, we see that a lot in a radio station. It always drives me crazy when I pull a reel, get a radio reel, and somebody stuck some adhesive, and you can't get it off the flange. It's terrible. And place the tape in a good quality container, preferably one that will not shed or break down. The 3M Library Box is one of the best designed audio tapes that I know of. Unfortunately, it's unclear whether 3M will continue to make this box available. They actually didn't really make it available in the first place because you had to buy the tape to get the box. I fortunately had a recording project that we did. The good news is we had archival boxes. The bad news is we did the whole thing on 3M tape. Unfortunately, it's unclear whether 3M will continue to make this box available or allow others to do so after they leave the magnetic tape business later this year. A call to your local 3M representative or Chris Benner of the 3M marketing transition team might be in order. I've got that number here if somebody wants that number. You let them know about your concern and need for this container, and it might just help a little bit. Be sure that the tape is staged at least at the intended storage environment before packaging it and sending it off to storage. Store tape standing upright, not laying flat or leaning, on solid shelving in a dark, clean, dust-free area. Don't allow any food or drink or smoking in the area of tape preparation. Use or storage at 40 degrees Fahrenheit or 20% relative humidity for archival storage. Keep the environment as stable as possible. And I think that's a really good point. If you had wide fluctuations in your relative humidity and your temperature, it will accelerate the deterioration of your tape. Even if you're not within the parameters that he described, if it's constant, it's much better. And we all know that we're at the mercy of the physical plant when it comes to our heating. I'm going to turn on the light again here. That's the last slide. We're getting to the tricky part here, and I need to be able to see this. In fact, if the storage area is not that stable, you can always get the environment down to these settings. Select an environment up to 65 degrees Fahrenheit and 50% relative humidity, the recommended environment for working collections. But be aware that the warmer and wetter the atmosphere, the shorter the life of your tape. For example, the IPI storage guide for acetate film estimates that new acetate-based motion picture film will develop vinegar syndrome in less than 20 years if stored at 80% relative humidity and 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Or it will be stayed off for over 1,200 years if stored at 20% relative humidity and 35 degree Fahrenheit. Though accidental erasure or damage to the signal is almost unheard of, the storage area should be free of external magnetic fields, nor should they be allowed in playback or packaging areas either. Maximum flux density permitted should be 10 Gauss. Airport walk-through metal detectors like X-rays and radiation from radar antennas, unless strong enough to be damaging to people, are reported to have no effect on recorded or unrecorded magnetic tape. The only reported problems come from some handheld metal detectors with powerful magnetic fields used in some European airports. These may partially erase recorded information. A separation of even 2 or 3 inches is adequate to protect tape from all but the heaviest of electrical equipment. To play, inspect the tape, stage it out of the storage area for from 1 to 50 days, depending upon the width of the tape and the storage environment. An audio cassette will acclimate itself in approximately 6 hours, a quarter-inch open reel tape in 24 hours, and a 2-inch reel-to-reel tape will require up to 50 days. The chart shown here, and this is, would you mind switching off, hey Dad, would you mind switching off or cooling down the
Sure thing there, Sonny.
I bow to the sage from Rome.
Thanks, Dad. Okay. There's the rundown on the acclimation time for various tape formats. And I think that's a good point and one that we frequently overlook. Keep your playback area cool, clean, and dry. The temperature should never exceed 75 degrees Fahrenheit, 60% relative humidity, and should preferably be 65% Fahrenheit and 50% relative humidity or lower. Playback equipment should be maintained according to manufacturer's specifications. Take the tape from its container only when needed and return it as soon as it has been played and, of course, properly rewound. Use the time that the tape is out to inspect for all the things that can go wrong: bad wind, sticking, bad reel, flanges or hub, print through, dirt, or debris on the tape. Even after 50 years, the jury is still out on periodic inspection of tape. Some say it places the tape in greater danger, since most damage will usually occur during handling and or playback. Others strongly recommend that tape be inspected every 2 or 3 years. The debate may be a moot point, since the reality of the matter is that most of us do not have the time or the resources to periodically go through our tapes and inspect, clean, repackage, and or retain them, and I think that's a very good point. Possibly, the compromise solution may be to monitor the storage area daily, or at least on a regular basis. When the occasion calls for the tape to be pulled, always handle, package, and clean it as though you are carrying out a scheduled inspection, keeping your eyes and ears open to potential problems. Properly rewind, clean as needed, package, and shelve any tape that is pulled from storage for any reason. Use the pulled items as a sample of the items around it. If you see something unusual, for example, you notice that hopefully first signs of sticky shed, examine other tapes in the area, particularly those that are from the same manufacturer and the same stock, especially if they were recorded and placed in storage at about the same time. And if you find problems, take care of them as soon as possible, since they will probably only get worse. If all else fails, schedule a periodic blind sampling of your collection. There are several sources that can help you assure that you are not subconsciously pre-selecting materials. Thus, within the maximum life built into the tape at its manufacturer, It is up to you how long you want your tape to last. Like all the data, the data dependent upon the life of the object to carry the data, magnetic tape is not permanent and is susceptible to physical and chemical breakdown. The rate at which such decay takes place is directly connected to how such carriers are packaged, handled, used, and especially to the environment from which they are in which they are stored. Jerry is very appreciative of the information provided and assistance given by a number of people, and particularly wants to thank John Van Bogart and their colleagues at the National Media Lab, Dell Eilers of 3M, Jim Wheeler, formerly of Ampex, Fred Lane of Ampex, Jim Linder of Vitapax, Joe Nork of Nork Audio Video, and John Mazzaroni of Sony, and especially helpful in the beginning of the process of comprehending magnetic tape and its properties have been the colleagues at the Library of Congress, Bob Carneal, now retired, Alan McConnell, and Larry Miller, as well as the staff of the Magnetic Recording Lab and Public Listening Viewing Unit, and also his many colleagues at ARSC in this room here, YASA and AES. And without all and many, many more, there would have been more errors and far less comprehension to this presentation, particularly if I hadn't read it. Regardless of this help, the final decision on what to include and exclude is and how to present must rest with Jerry. And he welcomes all your feedback for and comments, suggestions for clarity. I think this is really a nice candidate for publication in the Ars Journal because I think it contains a lot of very good basic information. Oh, that's much better. Now I can see you. Any questions? We have resident experts here on hand. Yes, sir.
I wonder if there are any at least anecdotal impressions that some manufacturers give you less sticky shed and so forth breakdown problems than others.
I think there's a general consensus that there are problem companies and particularly batches. And now I stand corrected. I'm a dilettante on this subject, really. But I see we've got an expert among us. Steve, you want to respond to that? I'm going to rely upon Steve and Seth. I'm going to delegate authority.
First of all, in direct answer to your question, each of the companies seems to have had problems with at least one group of tapes within its product line. The ones that Chuck read off, to which I would add the 3M 806 and the 808.
Yeah.
They have a test tape that was done in 1988, a setup tape that now has sticky shit.
Yeah.
Can you trust your friends? But even more to the point, none of the tape, even though the manufacturers say is a product of that period, of the periods in which these tapes were designed and marketed, I have yet to have even anecdotal reports of any tape that was not backcoded developing this problem. I don't know whether that's because the backcoded tape is more expensive and perhaps therefore other chemicals that are not, that won't allow if they're added to a cheaper tape for them to meet the price point in the market, but it's the more expensive chemicals that are causing problem, or if it's simply the backcoding process itself that's encouraging this process to happen. I don't know the answer to that, but that is, unless anyone else here has experience with a non-backcoded tape causing the sticky shed or any of the other hydrolysis problem.
There was one batch of an audio tape went out of business. The non-black backcoded material would squeal, the lubricant would dry out of it. It wouldn't shed. But there were a number of people who had gotten tapes from one of the people out on the West Coast, you know, who dealt in underground tapes. And God help me, I've had some of those reels, and they're impossible to resurrect in any way, shape, or form.
So it's a lubricant problem here rather than a hydrolysis problem.
Right.
But Jerry, I don't believe, mentioned the hydrolysis underpinnings of the sticky shed problem. But that's a chemical process that begins by water. Water vapor binder is exposed to that water vapor, and a chemical process begins, which ultimately develops into this variety of ills. There was a couple of points that Jerry made that I think need either elaboration or clarification. The electron microscope pictures were due to were initiated because of, up to this point, no one had ever figured out how to determine whether a tape has sticky shed or not, or has a squealing problem, or any of the other ills that we've been discussing here that relate to this binder breakdown without actually playing the tape. Mm-hmm. So what Jerry has been trying to do is to find a system of inspecting the tape without having to play it to determine whether this is a problem within the tape reel. And so he's been using the electron microscope and has noted these pits or dents in the binder at these high magnifications, as opposed to how the tape looks when it's brand new. But what we don't know is how that brand new tape would look if it were as old as the tape that's causing the problem. We have no control and no history of how tape ages naturally to compare this unnatural, if that be the case, aging as a match in the other side of the microscope eyepiece. So this may be leading to something, but we really don't know whether this is going to be true of all aging tape or simply true of tape that has this sticky shed or binder problem.
I think this is certainly a topic which needs further elaboration, but I think we're going to have to get...
There are a couple of other important points to make here.
Okay.
And I'll be off the floor in a minute. Baking tape. I've done a lot of tape baking. I know of other people who've done a lot of tape baking. We have never had a failure if it's been done properly. It has always worked if the problem has been identified properly before the tape went into the oven.
What do you use for icing?
very interesting question. And then the only other point, and the picture in the of the vault, beware of unfiltered ultraviolet light. It will attack the plastic in the tape. You need a sleeve or incandescent light. And that's the conversation at the moment.
All right. I think I'll turn the floor. This is something I think that we can further explore in Nashville, perhaps into greater detail, and maybe get a discussion going. Mike Beal, yes, sir.
Just one quick point. I'm surprised that Jerry said in there that there have been no tapes that have had vinegar syndrome. There was a tape that was passed around at IOSA several years ago from one of the archives that did have vinegar syndrome. The mitigating factor is, if I remember correctly, it was an East German Orwell brand tape, ORWO. And so it might not be a problem with those tapes from the Western countries. There may be problems more with the Russian and the East German tapes. When I was in Moscow, I went to the Moscow City Audiovisual Archive. And then again, this isn't tape, but this is something that you might have access to for some purposes. They had a lot of 35 millimeter full coat mag film, and it was fairly recent stuff. I think it was from 1972, and I just opened up a can of it, not knowing that it was mag film. I thought it was motion picture film, and the smell of vinegar just flew out of it, and every can I opened up, and there were about 175 of them, was just loaded with vinegar syndrome, although the film was in still physically good condition. The picture films that I just went around the room and spot open cans. Fine, it was just a mag stock. And one of the things which the people at Manchester University have said is that iron is a catalyst for vinegar syndrome. And that can also be the iron in the reels, in the cans, and the shelves.
Huh.
So that you need to, if you can, separate it, but you can't, of course, with magnetic tape, in a sense. The magnetic stripe on the edge of motion picture films from the 50s and 60s, that was how they realized that it was a catalyst, because a very, very high percentage of the collections they were that they were doing their research on. The tapes or the films with Vinegar Syndrome, a very high percentage of them were magstripe. And so I asked them one day at lunch, I said, well, what about magnetic tape? It really is nothing more than fold coat that's narrower. And they said, we hadn't thought about that. This was about 4 years ago. And we'll start investigating it. And there have been a few cases of it, but it'd be interesting to know if anybody here in the West has had any problems with vinegar.
I think this is this particular paper will be a catalyst for further discussion of the issues raised in here, and maybe I think more in depth. This is a nice overview, though. Yes, Seth.
I just wanted to add to what Steve was talking about concerning not playing a tape, finding out if it's good or bad. I had experience with one of the slugs concerning the tape, which had blocked. One of the clues I found, I had done this at the AES presentation in 1990, was to show this, was that I had a number of tapes that when we found out about it was when Clint went over to BMG Studios with the Toscanini reissues. They had one of these tapes. They put on also like the stripping sound that's worth blocking. They just wound it back on and handed it back to me, and I started looking at some of these tapes. And there is one way you can tell if you're not sure and you don't want to play it, is take the end of the tape and just hit it with some alcohol. If all of a sudden the oxide side gets very tacky and sticky, don't play that tape. That's one that is a perfect candidate for binding. But that's the only thing I've ever seen where you can tell of that kind of tape that you don't have to play it. And it's generally from a period in Scotch from somewhere in early 1953. There are tapes over at Sony from that same period where they're having that problem.
Acetate-based
tape. The Scotch was like a 111, I think, from that period. But that's the only time I've ever seen it where you actually can tell right away without playing it. In that instance. Yeah, then there were other problems too within that tape period. Some of the uneven packing you see was due to some bad slitters over at Scotch. Walter Toscanini was having a terrible problem with a lot of the tapes he was getting, and he called and he said, hey, we had a problem with some of the slitters as they cut the tape where they would start moving, they wouldn't stay in place. And I had that with, you'll find that in very early tapes, of the first acetate
or say cheap tape.
Later, oh yes, Irish and Shamrock, which he rejects from Ampex.
Boy, are we glad to see the Shamrock
in the collection. Yes, exactly.
And that also would make a problem with that literal transport that if that was too wide, the whole transport would just shut off. And that's some of the things you see there that unpacking just in one spot. But the only thing I've ever seen is the Scotch that you can actually do a test on that. The only reason why was I was replacing a splice and I was cleaning it and all of a sudden, what the heck is all this on here? And then it was why it only happened with those wheels that were that had blocked. That's all I can add in on that.
To note a couple corrections in the program. The ARSC editorial board meeting is going to meet at 12:30, not 12 o'clock, and it will be in the Bent Room, B-E-N-T, not the Benton Room.